Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am Dr. Ed Ackerley along with my co-host this morning, Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
I see you have your golf shirt on. That must mean you had some therapy this week, right?
Yes, three times.
Three times. Was there any rain or was it out of beautiful hot days?
Yesterday was beautiful. It was overcast and nice and cool.
Yeah.
By today's August standards.
Right. They say if you shoot your age, so if you're in your case, 62, if you're shooting a 62, that means you're doing pretty well at golf. So are you shooting your age at this point?
Yes, I am.
Yes, you are. Fantastic. Well, you were up in Phoenix playing too at a beautiful course. It was 115 degrees when you were playing, but it was not too bad, huh?
Can't pass up playing at the Phoenician. It's an absolutely beautiful golf club.
Yeah. Yeah.
Played there.
Hey, our good friend Mark Napier has declared for Oro Valley mayor, and I talked to him. It'll be interesting to see how that race pans out. So you know Mark from his years in law enforcement.
Yes, and Mark committed to teaching me how to drive a race car. He hasn't done that yet,
okay.
But he was a teacher of NASCAR.
Oh, he was, yeah.
And a driving instructor.
Well, he's in a different kind of a race right now.
Yes, so he is.
He's going to be working hard for the next couple of months as he makes that run for mayor of Oro Valley, and Joe's term is up, so that'll be kind of an open race. It'll be interesting to see how that all pans out. So we wish him the best of luck up in Oro Valley. Well, today we talk about business success stories in the first hour. The second hour we'll be talking about Wonder, the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Our guest for business success of the first segment is Kari Gallardo, along with her husband Ismael. They are the owners of Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supplies. Good morning, Kari.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. You had a nice little ribbon cutting the other day of your expanded facility over on Alvernon Way, and Matt and I were there. It was very nice, very, very classy.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you for being there.
A lot of people there. That was kind of cool. So tell us a little bit about how Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supply got started.
Well, going back many, many years, 1987, my mom actually started, and back then it was Janko Janitorial.
Right.
And she had it for many years, started it out of the house, of course, and doing mm-hmm. the cleaning. And then she partnered up with my uncle, Fernando Gonzalez, and then they had the company together for many years. And then finally in 2018, my husband and I had an opportunity to take over if we wanted, and we felt it was the right time, and it was that move that we needed, and there we went.
Are you both there full time?
No, Ismael does work during the day.
He
does have a day job.
That's what they say to me when I'm down at the University of Arizona. They say, "Don't quit your day job. You may not be here very long." So.
Exactly. You never know. So yeah, we have that backup.
Yeah, that's great. But he does spend a lot of time there. I'm sure
he does. So, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What kind of, and when it was Janko and now that it's Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supply, you kind of have transitioned, you still do cleaning and so forth, but you also now are much more into the supply side of things, supply side economics, I guess that's called. So you're a little more retail based with your new facility. Tell us a little bit about that transition, what services you offer in terms of cleaning, but also then the products that you sell.
Yeah. So of course we still offer commercial cleaning. We still have commercial cleaning clients. Mm-hmm. We still do portering, disinfection services, full floor care, all of that. But now we have the retail. So we're able to offer a lot of the products that we're using doing the commercial cleaning, now offering it to the public.
Am I allowed to break the news and say what you're going to be doing with your products in the future?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So our next step is that we will be introducing a line of our own products of cleaning supplies. So we're excited for that.
That's great
to develop
those and to make those cool.
Yeah.
So Matt was telling me the other day when we were at the event that he was actually got something that he wanted to do. He wanted to clean his wife's car, and he was looking for some specific things, and he got what are those things called, Matt? Surgical cloth? Is that what they're called?
Is that the right, Kari?
Yeah.
Is that surgical towels?
Surgical towels.
So, I've just been having trouble getting the windows clean on the car. Okay, and either streaking or whatever. Microfiber towels aren't just right, and Kari fixed me up with some window cleaner that they sell, which is really good, but the towels were still, so she says, these are the towels you want right here, and she was right. So yeah, they'll solve problems for you.
Yeah.
What makes a surgical, I'm just curious, what makes a surgical different from a microfiber towel?
Yeah, it's lint-free.
Lint-free.
That's one of the major things, but it just doesn't.
That's why it's probably called surgical, so it doesn't leave anything behind.
Yes, correct. Yeah. And it just leaves that nice, clean, super clean glass.
Well, I'll have to stop by and get some for my grandsons to clean my windows of my car. So.
Put them to work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So how has the business evolved then from that beginning with your mom and your uncle and Janco to this retailing and now moving into your own products? It's really kind of changed the focus of what you're doing on a daily basis.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Keeping everything the same, but going in different directions as well at the same time.
Correct, yeah. We've always honored, you know, the small business, locally mm-hmm. owned and operated. We've had approaches that people wanted to open franchises, but we kind of just wanted to keep that
right.
small business and locally owned. And then, of course, rebranding in 2020 to our name. So.
Right. You had a facility over by the 22nd Street overpass over there, and you're getting out just in time. It's been 36 years since they said they were going to widen the 22nd Street overpass. It'll probably be another 36 years before they get it started and get it done. But so you've still have that facility, but you've moved from there over to Alvernon. So tell us your address and your new expanded location over on Alvernon.
Yeah, so we're at 1801 South Alvernon, Suite 104, just north of 29th. In the EG Shopping Center there.
That's a good locator. That EG's on the corner there.
Yeah.
Everybody knows where that is, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So we had a ribbon cutting earlier this month, mm-hmm. and what did that moment mean for you and your team after working really hard at trying to expand and you basically doubled the size of your space? You have a little warehouse behind, and it's kind of a nice change from an older house that you had a shed out back that you stored stuff in. So it's kind of a nice elevation of your offering, right?
Yeah, no, it was we were excited to have our close family and friends there. It meant a lot just to kind of have their support there, you know, and just kind of showing them what more or less we've accomplished and where we're going to go from here. So okay. It was great.
Our guest today is Kari Gallardo, along with her husband Ismael. They are the owners of Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supplies and a beautiful new facility, expanded facility, I should say, over on South Alvernon Way, Alvernon and 29th by the EGs there. Sixto, you had a question?
Yes. Kari, for someone who hasn't visited yet, what kind of products and services does Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supply offer?
So the cleaning part, of course, we offer all the commercial cleaning services, but then definitely our store. We have, being in the new storefront, we're able to display a lot more products from mop heads, all types, flat mops, microfiber. And then just being able to display more on the floor for them and carrying more in-stock items.
Are these specialty items like for commercial clients, or can people who own a house come in and buy?
Both. We're open to the public and open to businesses. So
if you have, I just ironically asked my house cleaner when she comes in on Monday, would she take extra care in the brand new, our shower is probably only a year and a half, but already the floor of the shower is a little bit darker compared to the tile around it.
Yes.
And I said, can you dig into that a little bit for me and make that bright and shiny like mm-hmm. it was when we first got it? You probably have something for that, right?
Send her our way, and okay. I will definitely help her.
I will tell her. Diana, if you're listening, we know where you need to go to get that fixed. But so like for someone like me who has something like that, a special need, you can help kind of customize what you
yes.
need to make that happen.
Yes.
And that's probably a hard water stain. I would imagine that's probably hard water and a little
yeah.
bit of grime and soap and crap that's on there that... you have a brand new shower. It took us 2 years to get that in. Long story for that. But, I want to keep looking sharp as long as I can.
Of course.
So we're going to have to make that special and so forth. Are there any other specialty products or anything that are interesting that you can share with us? Something that, like hard water, soluble stuff or things that make shower doors look good or anything that you have special that we can come in and look at and see if it's good for our place?
Yes, we all our products are amazing. I can honestly say that everything works really well. We've used it at some time in our commercial cleaning part, so
right.
we're not just selling any product to you. We're selling stuff that we do know it works. But one of the ones that stands out is a hydrogen peroxide that came out in during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great disinfectant, and it breaks down into water. And it has like a 60-second kill time. So a lot of people enjoy that. And it's like an eco-friendly product.
Like wipe down your sinks and things like
everything.
That.
Everything.
Even your washing machine and things where
everything.
You've got
a Yeah, it's a great one step.
Door handles is a good one.
Disinfectant. And then it's more natural. It's nothing like, you know.
Like bleach or something like that that's going to smell or anything.
That's going to smell. I mean, we still have those because customers do enjoy those, but we do have the more natural ones. So.
Right. That's cool. You know, you guys, I got you hooked up for a little while when Mark was the general manager of Rito for us. You guys came out and were cleaning the Rito every weekend. We had 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 people a weekend out there, and what a mess those people made.
Oh, yes.
They were having a great old time, but you guys were fantastic and your crew coming out to Rito and cleaning up. So that commercial service of providing ongoing commercial support, mm-hmm. industrial support for some of those large facilities. You can do that with your eyes closed, right?
Yes.
That's kind of what you do.
Correct,
yeah. Got a lot of teams. Probably overnight, there were probably a lot of teams out working overnight.
They were. Yeah. We appreciate all our employees.
Thanks, then. Well, when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supply with Akari Gallardo and Sixto Molina. This is KVOI, 1030 AM, Tucson's live local talk radio, and you are listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. On Friday, we talk about business success. Along with me this morning is my co-host, Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, sir.
Our friend Jesse made a good run at City Council. Let's thank you for helping him with his campaign. I helped in the background, and I've been talking to Jesse basically every day the last couple of days. It's tough when you lose an election. You put all your blood, sweat, and tears into it, and you lose it. It takes a week or two before you kind of get back on track.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
You can't, but I can.
I feel it. Our guest this morning is Kari Gallardo, along with her husband Ismael. They are the owners of Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supplies. Good morning again, Kari.
Good morning.
So, Sixto, you had a couple questions there?
Yeah, just to follow up, a lot of people have dogs and cats mm-hmm. in the house. And what products do you have that could help mitigate the odors and sometimes the accidents that occur?
Yeah, so you do have to treat those with a bioenzyme, and those will help eliminate odors. Even you can use it's a multi-purpose thing. You can use it in your dumpsters, anything like that. But you don't want to just put a deodorizer over. It's just masking the smell. So definitely a bioenzyme, and we have several brands to pick from.
Okay, awesome. And that kills the odor, right?
Yes.
Yes, all right. Awesome.
Yeah, I was saying that I need it. Not that I have dogs and cats, but I have dogs and cats at my house. They just come from across the street, next door, behind the alley. And I got lots of dogs and cats in my house. And it's like, wait a minute, I don't have dogs and cats. Why am I cleaning this up?
So. Well, I can top that. I don't have dogs and cats either, but I do get visits from rattlesnakes, scorpions, mountain lions, bobcats, coyotes. So, Kari, how important is community involvement in your business?
It means a lot to us. My husband and I, we love seeing, just what we dedicate and, donate money to or anything like that. Just seeing it, going and watching the kids. So we donate to clubs and sports down in Sahuarita. Here in Tucson, we were part of the Coaches for Charity. We love donating for that, the Thanksgiving meal. It's just important to us, to make sure that people know that we are, we do care. We're not just a business here in Tucson or in Sahuarita.
I think that's important because people do feel that when you are part of the community.
Yes.
You're not just a business, but you are part of it.
Correct.
And people do feel that.
Yeah.
So what are some ways that you've connected with local organizations or events here in Tucson?
Well, we have worked with the Coaches of Charity. We do donate on a yearly basis for Jesse Lugo, the bikes. We do donate backpacks to the local one, the police department. They have the back to school, and we actually have our own also. We do school supplies for our employees and the neighborhood kids there.
Awesome.
So, we've got a couple of AIA referees coming in, recruiting football referees coming in next after you. And of course, next weekend, we're going to have a couple of coaches from Sahuarita and Walden Grove because the Coaches for Charity Kickoff Classic is a week from yesterday. Is that right, Bill? Or 2 weeks from yesterday? The 28th. So it is the 28th. And it'll be, that is next week, right? I don't know. 2 weeks. We're at the 15th. Okay. So it'll be 2 weeks from Thursday, two Thursdays from now. And that'll be down at Walden Grove. And yes. So you're helping with that because you've provided some, we have some gift bags for the kids to thank them for their playing in this important game. But it's on a Thursday night, which will be good for the kids. They get to go out on a Thursday night to a football game, and hopefully that'll help us get some coverage with lots of TV stations there. So we appreciate what you and your husband and your company have done to support Coaches for Charity, not only this kickoff classic, but also the, as you say, the Thanksgiving food distribution. We have 8 schools now that we it's kind of fun, isn't it, to run around and deliver Thanksgiving boxes to schools?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It was awesome, you know, to see the expression on people's faces when you show up with the boxes. Yeah.
There's one school in particular, I won't mention Utterback, but it's interesting how the families that are receiving the boxes, they have a drive-through pickup, and they line up, and there's 25, 30 people in a row waiting to pick up their box, and that could be their Thanksgiving meal. So it's kind of, you know, you can't be all things to everybody.
Yes.
But we sure can make a difference in some people's lives, and that's kind of important.
Exactly.
So one of the things that, as Matt was kind of saying, is customer service. Mm-hmm. This is kind of, you know, you go to a big box store or something like that, and you go into a big aisle and you see 9,000 products, and I have no idea which one I need for, like, my deal with getting my floor cleaned in my shower. Customer service is really the hallmark of what you do. You have great products, great services, you got great crew and staff helping, but it's the customer service that's a really powerful thing in your company.
Yes, it's super important to me. I want people to leave happy and satisfied. So, you know,
A little more knowledgeable about what they're doing.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. So anything that we can do to help them, guide them, you know, if they have 100 questions, I'm there to answer them. I don't mind, you know, and they love that. They truly love that. We've had customers in and saying, wow, this is, you know, your customer service is great. So,
right.
You know, after they leave, like, have you seen it? You know, the small business owners do a little happy dance. I'm like that because, you know, every customer matters to us. So
right. And the nice thing about the way your store is situated and so forth, and you can, it's not like you're doing a turnstile and your nag, take a number, we'll be with you in 4 hours. It's, you come in, someone's with you right away, and they can walk you right to what you need and explain to them what they need to do in order to get their place clean. So that's great. And this is not only for individual residents, residential homes, people coming to clean their own house, but you can do the same thing with people who are responsible for a facility, the janitorial team, all the people that are responsible for keeping a place tip-top shape. Bring them in and you can walk them through what they need to do as well. And that's important, I think, that professionals know that they have a place that they can go and get some answers.
Exactly. Because even though you know, we've been in the field for many years or anything, you always have questions, you know,
right.
So it's, we never...
Well, we've talked a little bit about the next 5 years, which is basically you're going to expand into your own product line here. That's pretty exciting. Any plans for a store in Sarita or a store in Northwest Tucson or going up to the Valley in Phoenix or anyplace else? Expansion plans?
We are definitely looking at either East Sarita or Marana. We see the growth there, and we definitely are looking, you know, in the next year or two, opening a storefront.
That Sarita will be nice because you could just get out of your car and walk 10 feet to the store as opposed to driving up here every morning. It's like, it's not a long drive. It's probably no farther to come from Sarita up here than it is for me to come to East Tucson to here. So people think that it's a long way, but the reality is you're here a moment in 15 minutes. You're basically anywhere in Tucson, right?
Exactly.
It just seems like it's farther away.
It does, but when you start doing it every day, you don't feel the difference.
For those of us that have lived here a long time, we always thought the Green Valley and Sarita was way down there. And it's city all the way now, so it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Well, this is called Success. We do success stories on the first hour on Fridays, and part of that comes from when Six and I were running for mayor. We would get pinned against the wall, and people would tell us how terrible life is in Tucson and what a horrible government we have and how horrible the city is. And then I'd look at them and say, well, why are you living here? And then they would say, and they'd just gush about their weather, the family, they're growing up here, the schools, the football, all the things. They would just talk, you know. So this show is about the second half of that conversation. A lot of people can bash a lot of things, but we have a lot of great companies here like yours that are doing great things. How do you define success?
You know what? I think it's a balance of a lot of things, not only business goals, but also personal goals. So I can say that truly we're in success now,
yes,
but we still have a lot to go. But when I can check off boxes off our bucket list, and you know, for the business and personal, I feel like I'm in success right now.
Well, you've raised three nice young men in your family, and you are successful in your business, you and your husband. And I have to just say, your husband is quite the gentleman. He's so gracious to me when I come in there and talk to him. He's an absolutely very pleasant guy. So I hope you tell him I said that. So.
I sure will.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate all you do for the community and all the things that you do behind the scenes to make our community better and more successful. And we wish you a lot of success too.
Thank you.
As you kind of enjoy the newly expanded Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supplies. So where are you located again, so people can come see you, or if they want to make a phone call, or maybe they live in Sahuarito or in West Tucson and just need to have a question answered, how do they get a hold of you?
So they can come visit us at the store, 1801 South Alvernon, Suite 104, or they can call us at 520-495-4097, or even check out our website. We actually have online shopping, so it's southernazclean.com.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you again for being with us. We look forward to seeing you, next week at the football game. And thanks to Kari Gallardo, and Ismael of Southern Arizona Cleaning and Supplies. And thank you, Sixto, for being here. We'll come back with some AIA officials in a moment. This is KVOI 1030 AM, Tucson's live local talk radio. And you're listening to The Morning Voice. Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice on this Friday. On Friday, we talk about success stories and talk about good things going on in our community. And my co-host this morning is Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Eckerly.
Hey, you and I both had some boys that played not only high school football, but went on to the college scene and had a great experience playing. Your son played for the University of Arizona. My son played up in Minnesota, and a great experience for our kids, and really turned him into a delightful young man.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the camaraderie that goes on within the team. Yeah. And the coaches and the environment is just awesome.
Learning discipline, leadership, teamwork, all those collaboration, all those wonderful things that just any sport would give you. But and you and I are junkies. We go to the U of A football games together and break into the Sands Club at the halftime. And
I'm going to exercise my rights to remain silent.
We go see Matt because Matt pays for his tickets. We just bust in on a regular basis, and we say we know Matt Neely, and they let us in, so we love it. So, well, this morning we're going to talk a little bit about football because football is coming up. We have our first guest is Colin Waite. He's at the University of Arizona. He's the Cooper Center for Environmental Learning director of that at the University of Arizona, but he's also with the Arizona Interscholastic Association. He's in a football official of all things, and he runs up and down the field and gets our high school players and our varsity and JV players to play the game with the right rules and right thing. Welcome to you again, Colin.
Thanks very much for having me, Ed. It's great to be here.
Thank you for what you do to help kids play the game right. And we always say that if you leave a football game and you don't notice that the referees were there, it was a good game. That means that that means that the kids played well and the guys didn't have to shut anything down that was egregious. Same thing is true of baseball and other things as well.
Yep.
Well, why you've been officiating all these years? What got you into being an official? And you kind of wear two hats because you work during the day at the U of A and then you go out and officiate during the fall at night, and that's kind of fun, isn't it?
It's absolutely. It's an incredible opportunity to teach in a different setting. You know, when I'm working at Camp Cooper, it's working with kids outdoors. It's very similar in working with football and why I got involved that way. You know, I've been doing it for 20 years, and it was really wanting to find a way to give back to the community a little bit more. I've always loved football, been a Bears fan since I was 8 years old, love college football too. And this was really the opportunity for me to get involved.
And so these high school officials, they're pretty important to the game, obviously. We're going to talk in a little bit after the break. We're going to talk a little bit about safety, how important that is. But learning the rules to the game and playing the game is important. And, you know, keeping everybody, you know, it's an emotional game to start with. Just football by its very nature is kind of a very active sport. And can lead to a lot of emotions erupting on sidelines and so forth, or even on the field. And your job is to kind of keep everyone kind of chill and let's just play this game and do the best we can, right?
Well, you know, when I'm out on the field, I really think about my job as keeping everybody safe, making sure that folks know the rules. And again, it is a teaching opportunity, especially at the high school level. And so being able to work with kids and coaches, even parents sometimes, when it comes to the rules. But, you know, to have the game played right, it's a constant learning opportunity for everybody who's involved, including us as officials. Yeah, it's knowing those rules and knowing how to apply them in the right situations.
That's great. So there's a talk from time to time about a shortage of officials, that we don't have enough officials, people volunteering their time to come out and be an instructor. So we have both little peewee games on weekends and so forth, and then we have some of the elementary schools and some of the middle schools and so forth have some flag games and so forth. And then you get into the junior varsity, freshman junior varsity, varsity teams that are playing at a pretty high level, especially here in Tucson. We have some couple big teams that are playing Phoenix teams, and they're, you know, just shy of maybe what a junior college team would be playing. So they're pretty significant teams, and we need officials for all levels of that, right?
Right.
So what's the situation in Arizona about needing officials?
There's definitely a need for officials, not just for football, but for all sports. And whether we're talking about youth sports or high school, there's definitely a need. We're looking for folks who love the game, who love working with kids, like to be active and out on the field. Really, it's all different abilities. You've got folks who know the game and have played the game. You've got folks who are relatively new to it and are learning it on the go. There's a huge opportunity right now. In Southern Arizona, we added flag football for girls for high school this a few years ago. Last year, there were, I think, 3 teams, and this year there are 15 here in Southern Arizona. The Phoenix area, they went from, I think, around 45 schools to 130 schools with flag football. And so there's a huge opportunity for new officials who are interested in the game. You don't necessarily do it for the paycheck, but it is a pretty nice paycheck to work these games, make a little supplemental income, have a little side hustle. There are more games now than there have been in many years. Mm-hmm. When I started as an official 20 years ago, I only had one varsity game my first year, and it was at the end of the season. This year, there will be first-year officials who will work varsity games right at the beginning of the year. That's how short we are. And so if we want the game to be officiated well, we've got to recruit new folks so that we can train them in how it's done, give them those JV and freshman games to get practice on. And if we build up enough folks, then we'll be in a position where we've got great officiating for those high school games on Friday nights.
Our guest this morning on The Morning Voice is Colin Waite. He is the director of Kent Cooper Center for Environmental Learning at the University of Arizona, but he's also an Arizona Interscholastic AIA football official. We've seen a lot of good officiating in our time watching football, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Yeah. And it's awesome. What concerns me, though, is what I've been reading in the papers, is that now many of the parents are getting a little bit hostile toward officials. Yeah. And maybe that's an understatement. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
Yeah.
Well, what I would say is that it's really, in my mind, it's not as bad as it's made out to be publicly. Mm-hmm. But you got to have a thick skin. And after you've got some practice on games, you don't hear that noise as much. But the public perception that of being abused as officials is something that makes it incredibly hard to recruit.
Right.
You know, folks don't want to go into a job where they're going to get yelled at.
Right. They don't come to work for our company,
though. Thank you.
So
Bill will yell at you. Yeah.
You certainly have to have patience, and you have to have that ability to listen and to talk to folks even when they're upset.
Right.
If we had more understanding community members and fans and parents, it would make it a lot easier for us to recruit and have a better game.
I wrote a book called Creating Magic, and in there I tell the story of I was a volleyball official when I was a young man, and I was officiating a game, and there was this one person that was kind of popping off every time I'd make a call. He popped off, and it was egregious. And I eventually jumped down off the standard, walked over, and I hung the whistle on my finger, and I handed it over to him. I said, if you think you're so good, you get up there and do it. And that stopped all the complaints after that.
Yeah.
And so sometimes when the parents and others look at this, they get a little little upset and so forth. Come on out. Let's see if you can give it a shot and see how good you are at it. And you take the abuse that you're giving out and see if you like it. So just a different perspective, I think, to look at that. So you don't need to necessarily be know all the rules of the game in order to be official, right? Because you teach them the rules, right?
Absolutely.
It's learn on the job, basically.
It is learn on the job. I think I signed up on a Tuesday, and I was working a scrimmage on a Wednesday, one of my first year as an official. I didn't even have my belt. I had to hold my pants up the entire game because I'd forgotten my belt, and I'm never gonna live that one down.
Right.
Yes, I mean, you're going to be given rule books. There is a rules exam that everyone takes. It's one of the ways that you qualify for playoff games and for moving into higher ranks of officiating, getting better games. But you're really learning from veteran officials. And what I love about football officiating is that it's a team effort. You know, we come together to make the calls. If I throw a flag and somebody else saw something different, we can talk about it. I can pick up the flag if somebody's convincing in their argument. And so we're gonna train those new officials. Last night at our scrimmage at Tankaverde, we had two brand new officials. They were on the field. We were giving them feedback and input as they were working plays between those two teams.
So what is how many officials, like say for a major varsity game, how many officials do you have on the field at one time?
For a regular season game, you're typically going to have five officials. You're going to have a referee, an umpire, a head linesman, a line judge, and a back judge. I typically work the back judge position.
So you're back there with the safeties running like a crazy man down the field, huh?
Exactly. At 47 years old, I've got to get a big head start, 20 to 25 yards ahead of them, so that I can get to the end zone before they do.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's
great. For the playoff games, we typically have seven officials, so you'll have a couple of other officials deep, so that you can really manage those sidelines, manage those long plays a little bit better.
Great. We're talking with Colin Waite. He is director of Camp Cooper at the Center for Environmental Learning at the University of Arizona. He's also an AIA football official. We're talking about high school football coming up here starting next Thursday, the 28th. We've got a first game for us. Coaches for Charities hosting the Sarita Walden Grove game at Walden Grove at 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 28th. When we come back from break, we're going to talk a little bit about safety and about what officials and coaches and adults and sponsors can do to help make sure that our kids, when they're playing this fantastic game, are going to be safe and secure. So we'll come back and talk with one of our buddies from Phoenix, Georgie Donchez. She's with Red Cross. We'll talk with her when we get back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We're talking football here on The Morning Voice. It's fall. We're going to start football in a couple of days, the 28th at Walden Grove, the first official kickoff, Coaches for Charity Kickoff Classic. Our guest this morning is Colin Waite, who is an AIA football official. My co-host is Sixto Molina. On the line with us, we have Georgie Donchez. She's from Red Cross, Arizona. Good morning, Georgie. How are you doing?
Good morning. Thank you guys for having me on.
Great. We've been talking about football and about being outside, and Matt just mentioned that we're going to be in triple digits again. So it's really important that we protect students during outdoor workouts. So you guys have issued a press release talking about extreme heat happening more often, lasting longer, and getting more intense. Tell us a little bit about the initiative of American Red Cross to remind coaches, parents, and officials about the dangers of being out in this heat.
Yeah, I mean, obviously here in Arizona and Tucson, we are used to these heat waves, right? These aren't something that are new to us. But I think what we're starting to see across the country is that people don't think heat waves are going to affect them, and they do. A recent study came out saying that 43% of adults don't believe a heat wave will have any negative impact on their lives. So we are really working at the American Red Cross to increase our awareness of what heat illness is, how you treat heat illness, but more importantly, how are we keeping our kids safe as they return to their sports during these triple digits?
So, Colin, you were refereeing a scrimmage last night at Tankaverde. Tell us a little bit about what you guys did in order to make sure that they could endure that 90-degree weather at that time last night.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing for us is extra water breaks, really making sure that kids have more opportunities to get to the sideline and hydrate. We talk a lot with the head coaches and with the trainers on each team just to make sure that they're watching kids closely. And then obviously, if we're seeing kids on the field and they're having issues, we're going to stop the play. We're going to stop what's happening so that they can get that extra assistance.
That's great. And Georgie, your initiative is to contact, obviously you've contacted the community to make them aware of this, but you're also working specifically with the high schools and the elementary schools and so forth, of all kids at all levels, at all organizations to try to get the word out that doing an outdoor workout at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when it's 117 degrees out is probably not the best thing to do for your child, right?
Yes, definitely would never recommend doing that. But we're actually even seeing those 5 a.m. workouts that like that high school students are doing. When you go from AC, you know, maybe a 70-degree house to all of a sudden 90 degrees in the morning, it is so important to get those a nice long warm-up to really let your body adapt to that heat. And that's going to not only help with the injury, but just kind of getting your body accustomed to that morning heat as well.
And also you're encouraging them to know the signs, and obviously the coaches and the athletic staff, the trainers and so forth, and as well as officials and even parents. But also the child, the kid that's playing also needs to understand. And this goes for cheer teams as well, and band members and all the people that are going to be out working out in the heat. It's not just the kids running around on the field per se. It's the 100 people in the band. It's all the people that are cheering and doing that kind of stuff. Know the signs of what it's like to get heat exhaustion. So what do they need to know about heat exposure and heat exhaustion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And like you said, this goes for even the parents, everyone who is out in that heat. So a lot of these students who are, you know, actively playing, they're going to might see heat cramps. And that's going to kind of trick some people, right? Because cramping is sometimes part of sports. But heat cramps are usually an early sign of trouble. And they are signaled by heavy sweating and muscle pain. So definitely stopping what they're doing and getting them into a cool spot will be important. And then having them sip on some water and a sport drink. If they start to feel nauseous, that usually means they're starting to move into that heat exhaustion. And that is going to be more serious, signaled by heavy sweating, weakness, and, you know, cool and clammy skin. So that is going to be kind of when you start to think about maybe this is a time where I call 911, maybe get a medical team out here to make sure everything's okay. It's important to loosen that clothing, putting a wet cloth on the body, and really trying to get their body temperature down. And then heat stroke is when things can get deadly. So that is signaled by a high body temperature, rapid heartbeat. You're going to see a lot of confusion and no sweating at all. So during that, you want to call 911, try to get them in a cool place, and you actually do not want them to be chugging water, sipping water, making sure it's very slowly intake, but getting them into that cool space is going to be super important.
That's great. Where can people go to get some more information from the American Red Cross about working out in the heat, and where can parents and coaches go?
Yeah, so we recommend that everyone downloads the Red Cross First Aid app, because it's hard to remember all of these signs and symptoms and what to do. So the First Aid app actually has all of this in there. So if you have a kid that's maybe experiencing some heat illness, it'll walk you through these symptoms and then what to do afterwards. So it's on your phone. You can get it on Apple or for Android. And it's just good to have it there in your pocket if you do come across someone who might be experiencing heat illness.
That's great. Georgie, thank you for what you've shared with us this morning. Hang on for just a second. Sixto has a question about officials. So
yes, Colin, if somebody was interested in becoming an official, how would you go about it? Who would you call? Is there a website you go to?
Yeah, there are a couple of different websites where you can get information. The best place for information is azfoa.org. That's the Arizona Football Officials Association, azfoa.org. You can also email one of our Tucson officiating board members at azfoatucson@gmail.com. And then you can also go to the main Arizona Interscholastics Association page for information on registration.
Georgie, thank you so much for being with us and sharing the safety tips from the American Red Cross. We appreciate all you do to keep people safe. Colin, we want to thank you and your team for coming on and keeping our kids safe on and enjoying the game. And we hope that we can get some people to be recruited and come on and help be officials during the high school football season. So thank you both for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Morning Voice on KVOI, 1030 AM. We'll be back with Wonder from the University of Arizona after the break. Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. My co-host this morning is Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
Do we have any therapy scheduled for this weekend? Are you going out on Sunday to play some golf?
Sunday and Monday.
Sunday and
Going
Monday.
Going to Phoenix on Monday to play.
That'll be great. Well, you deserve it. That's one of the beauties of not having a full-time job. You can get out and do a little bit of golfing every once in a while, right?
Yeah.
You're going to have to drag me out again and suffer through another game with me. That was torture the last time we went out for you, I'm sure. Well, this is The Morning Voice, and we're talking about Wonder with good things going on at the University of Arizona, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on historic 4th Avenue and our friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union. Our guests this morning are Bruce Burgess, who is Director of Venture Development, and Paul Tumarkin, from Assistant Director of Marketing and Communications at Tech Launch Arizona at the University of Arizona. Good morning, Bruce, and good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ed.
So, Bruce, just tell us a brief little bit about you and how you got to be part of Tech Launch Arizona.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting us to join you this morning. My background is in industry. I've been involved in early-stage companies throughout my career. And it started right out of grad school. Mm-hmm. I went to the University of Michigan and was actually working on a prototype for a monitor for cardiovascular surgery during my graduate program, as well as working with Eli Lilly on our artificial pancreas program. And the cardiac monitor was something that just as I was finishing my degree, the two faculty that were working on that got funding to take that forward as a product. And they invited me to join the company. And we were very successful and were able to market that product, and it was acquired by a St. Louis company, moved to St. Louis, and have been involved in early-stage healthcare companies ever since. We moved to Tucson about 12 years ago, and that was right about the time Tech Launch Arizona was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened just by pure serendipity to be on the university campus during one of their discovery days, mm-hmm. and got the opportunity to sit at a table with David Allen, who was brought in to start mm-hmm. what is now Tech Launch Arizona, which is the tech transfer arm of the University of Arizona. And he invited me to help build what is now the Venture Development Group within Tech Launch. Venture Development, we help faculty that want to commercialize their research through a startup company. There's a couple ways that that research could find its way into the marketplace. One is to find a company that already is out there that would be interested. But most times, the research is so early, it needs a startup company. It needs a new company to take it mm-hmm. forward. And we help them through that process.
That's great. That's a great service. And Paul, a little bit about you. Welcome back. By the way, you came to jump in Tucson when we had that. Now we're at the Morning Voice. Welcome a little bit earlier in the morning for you. But tell us a little bit about your job there as the in charge of marketing for Tech Launch.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I am the Assistant Director for Marketing Communications at TLA. So I came to TLA actually kind of as a little bit of a side angle. My background is in marketing communications. I got my graduate degree in foreign language and found that communications was really where I wanted to be. And so after many, many years of doing both freelance communications and marketing communications for companies, both large and small, I got a job at the University of Arizona. And I was working in the central marketing and branding mm-hmm. group. And then
was that under Steve Moore or before that?
It was actually before Steve Moore.
Before Steve, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. At one point, it was actually when Bruce was just talking about when TLA was getting started, they were looking for a marketing communications mm-hmm. person. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. And I, like Bruce, had a meeting with Dave. We sat at a table out on the mall mm-hmm. Having coffee together. And he told me about what they were doing. And I told him about what I was doing. And he said, I think you'd be great for this. And I thought, this is really neat opportunity. It's fascinating stuff. I'd never really worked in this area before. I didn't even know what technology right. transfer was.
Right.
And didn't know this kind of work happened at universities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the job and have been there ever since, and it's been fantastic.
It's kind of been a generator, this whole process of taking ideas from some guy sitting around thinking of something, and then she takes it out to the world, and you guys help launch it into the world. And you could probably name 50 things off the top of your head that started right here at the U of A and then have moved into the private sector or to the commercial sector and so forth. So, Paul, can you summarize Tech Launch's Arizona's performance metrics for 2025? You've done a lot of things in this last couple of months, right?
Yeah, yeah. 2025 was a really great year for us. And we talked fiscal years.
Fiscals, right.
So we measure our fiscal year from July 1st to June 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And this past year, we had the most. So we register invention disclosures, right? Those are reports of new inventions, technologies that come out of research at the university. And that's kind of the front of the pipeline. That's what really fills our work. And so this year we had 324 invention disclosures that came from faculty, graduate students, and staff. So that was fantastic. That's up from 307 in the previous year. So we're continuing to increase. We also had 94 patents issued. We executed 86 licenses for University of Arizona Technologies, and we launched 13 startup companies. So it was a great year.
That's a great year. Sixto's got a question for Bruce.
Bruce, U of A Inventions generated $12.1 million in royalty income in fiscal year 2025. How does that compare to previous years, and what does it signal for the university's research commercialization model?
I think we'll see that be pretty steady for the coming years. Hopefully, it will slightly increase. We've got some new companies that we think are just ready to get on the market, and we'll start to generate royalties from that. I think one number that maybe people aren't aware of, but at the University of Arizona, we've had over 225 new companies formed, and 160 of those are just in the past 12 years, 160 just since TLA was formed. And this year we had a major milestone in that those companies over the past 10 years alone have now raised over $1 billion, which is an astounding mark when you think about the investment right. that's been put into university startups. So I think what the royalties really signify is it validates the commercial value of research coming out of the university. And I think that's important to understand. And it also underscores why it's important to support this tech transfer effort. Because these technologies won't find their way on their own. It takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of effort to get them to the point where they're commercially viable, that their products are successful and on the market.
And with your experience, your team obviously knows where to go, who to go to, where to go, how to make that all happen. Whereas you're just a couple of professors who have a good idea, you maybe not be experienced in all of that. So it helps kind of manipulate through all that red tape and everything that you would need to get started, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
from forming a new company to whatever you need to go from there.
I mean, obviously it takes a good idea, but a good idea is just the start.
Right.
At the end of the day, it takes good people and it takes funding. And without those, a good idea will languish.
Right. Our guest this morning for Wonder are Bruce Burgess, Director of Venture Development, and Paul Tumarkin, Assistant Director of Marketing and Communications at a wonderful organization as part of the University of Arizona called Tech Launch Arizona. And I mentioned that Wonder, what you've just talked about and the benchmarks for all the great success you've had, is exactly what I talk about when I talk about Wonder, that people drive down Speedway and look over and see those red brick buildings. They have no idea what's going on over there, and they don't really understand the power that is being generated from that. And that's what you guys are doing, especially in your job, Paul, to kind of tell the story of this this burgeoning industry that's coming out of the University of Arizona Research.
Yeah, that's one of the... I've always loved being a storyteller. Mm-hmm. It's kind of what I do. I help people amplify their great stories. And the stories coming out of the university in terms of technologies and inventions that are really coming out to be able to impact people's lives, they're just inspiring. It's really amazing to see. Just this past year, we, like I mentioned before, we had those 13 startups.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to jump ahead a little bit, but right. one of the great startups out of the university was one called NeuroID. Mm-hmm. And it was out, it was started by a professor and a graduate student out of the Eller College of Management. And they developed a new kind of software technique for measuring digital body language. And what does that mean? Well, essentially, it's a way to tell people if people are being honest or not as they're filling out forms online.
Wow.
And they started this company. They built it for a few years. The company was actually launched in 2015, but just this past year, their company was acquired by Experian. Acquisitions for TLA are a huge win.
Part of that,
Bruce can certainly talk more about that.
Part of that process is that you've worked the first couple of years, no pun intended, but to get the bugs out and make sure it's working properly and everything is there. And then these larger companies come along and they get a turnkey product or whatever, whether it's ideas or whatever, and boom, they can take that and then market it on a big scale, right?
Yeah, the old model used to be that companies would develop these themselves internally. They would have huge labs, huge research organizations, and over the years and decades, that's actually migrated now, where companies are waiting until small companies develop the product, show that there's market acceptance, show that there's some traction in the market, and then what companies come in like Experian and say, we can take it the next step because we've got the resources, we've got the funding to be able now to expand it worldwide.
Right.
Where a small company would take a lot longer to do that simply because they don't have the resources
to
do that.
There's dozens and dozens and dozens of examples on the U of A campus, but one that pops into my mind is the optics side of things, where the optics research is being done at the University of Arizona. That's then being transferred to through TechLaunch into the private sector, and then that's going back out and ironically coming back to government in many respects because it's going to telescopes and medical and other things. And so that whole process of research on the university campus being launched into the private sector, powerful.
We talked about sometimes technology goes straight to a large company rather than going through a startup. And optics is one area where we have a huge success. Dr. James Swingerling invented a new intraocular lens, a lens that allows people when they have cataract surgery and they replace the lens in your eye, oftentimes their vision is fixed. And you can kind of decide, do you want far vision, near vision, somewhere in between? He developed a lens that can give you focal acuity at both near and far without reducing the quality of the image that you see. Mm-hmm. And that was licensed to Alcon. The intraocular lens is called the PanOptics, and it's been implanted in millions of eyes around the world. Just a huge success.
Great story. Our guests this morning on Wonder are Bruce Burgess and Paul Tamarkin from TechLaunch Arizona. After a quick break, we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the good things going on at TechLaunch Arizona. Our sponsors for Wonder are Hughes Federal Credit Union and Caruso's Italian Restaurant on historic 4th Avenue. And you're listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome back to Wonder, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Our guests this morning on Wonder are Bruce Burgess and Paul Tamarkin from TechLaunch Arizona at the University of Arizona. I am Dr. Ed Ackerley, along with my co-host Sixto Molina. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the U of A, and we call it Wonder. And Wonder is sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on historic 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. So, Bruce, if you could just walk us through a little bit of the venture development process when an invention gets put up for consideration, and how do you go about getting some help from investors and other people to make that happen?
It goes through a number of different steps, and it depends on sort of the maturity of the technology and where the research is and what stage it's in. And one of the first things people want to focus on is the technology itself and the product, and how do we get it to a point where now it's a commercial product and it's ready to sell. But that's only just a small piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. One of the main things that we impress upon them is that not to make assumptions as to what the market will want and what the market will need. So we have them.
That's always a danger, isn't it?
That's
to
always
assume
a danger.
What the customer wants, right?
We have them go through a program that we're part of, an iCore Hub, and that's a program that's supported and sponsored by the National Science Foundation. It's been in existence a little over 10 years now, and it's based on the work by Steve Blank up at Stanford. Steve Blank was a researcher there, and he wanted to understand why so many companies fail. You have all these new companies, great technology, but maybe only 1 in 10 survive. Why is that? And it's not because the idea wasn't good, although sometimes the technology just doesn't prove out, it's not capable. But what he really understood was that people make assumptions as to what the product should be without really understanding what people's view of that product would be and what their need is and what problem it's trying to solve. And so he developed what is called the Lean Startup Methodology. And that's the process by where you really understand what customer needs are and what product that they would actually buy and what product you could actually sell. And what that does is it allows you to get market quicker because companies that were failing were trying to do that iteratively. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you run out of money and you run out of time.
Right.
So we take them through that process, and it's a very important process because that then kind of lays out the groundwork for what you have to do to get the product ready, what the team needs are going to be, what expertise you're going to need, and most importantly, what funding you're going to need and when, and what those milestones are. So that then we can put a program together and say, okay, here's the types of funding that are available. Here's what's appropriate for this. Here's the time frames that are involved. We'll make the introductions. And that's just a really important part. So we don't cookie cutter our approach. We tailor our approach to each specific technology to make sure we're addressing their specific needs to bring that product forward.
Customizing it. So, Paul, can you just, that dovetails nicely into the Wildcat Seed Fund. Could you talk a little bit about that and how that all works?
Sure. The Seed Fund is designed to help these early stage companies advance. So these early stage companies with these young technologies are by nature very risky because they're so early stage. So we have to get these companies past what we call the Valley of Death. right? Where they're early stage, they could potentially fail. They don't have money. So through the Wildcat Seed Fund, which is a philanthropic seed fund, I'll describe that in a second, we help these early companies get a leg up, right? Get that first step so they can get to where they can succeed. The fund itself...
How do I apply?
Talk to Bruce.
Yeah.
The fund itself is... it's philanthropic, so we have donors who have, various donors who have contributed to the fund. It stands today at $2 million, a little over $2 million, and that was our initial threshold to begin making investments in these companies. So we're now at the stage where we're accepting applications. They're being vetted by a team that interestingly consists of both staff and students. We have students helping vet these. So it's a great student experience as well.
That's great. You had a question, Sixto?
Yes. What role does Tech Launch Arizona play in connecting university startups in Tucson with broader markets such as Phoenix, the West Coast, Boston, and what opportunities are emerging?
I'm glad you asked that because, like I mentioned before, people and funding are critical to the success of these startups. We can't do it ourselves. It takes a village, to use the old adage, for these startups to be successful. So there's just a lot more that's happening in the state of Arizona that we're working with and tapping into those resources. One of the resources that we have now is Startup Hub. It's on our website where we take these new startup ideas, market them on our website so that we can attract people. And that's attracting now people from New York, Boston, the Bay, Philadelphia, D.C., and that's so important to get quality people and executives aware of what we're doing here. Otherwise, you know, they just weren't aware of what's happening within Arizona. We're also working very closely with people up in Phoenix, with the Arizona Commerce Authority, with the AZ Tech Council, to help with funding, to help with programming, because these companies are going to need support all along the way, and we can't do it all ourselves.
Does this also expand in internationally? Are you working with transferring tech into international companies as well, maybe out of England or Germany or Japan or other places?
There is a new trend that's recent called startup studios or venture studios, and they understand the need to not only invest but to actually help create the company itself. And many of those are located in Europe and some in Europe and Japan. So we're working very closely with them to find out what they're interested in. We put together a portfolio of technologies for them to review. And then they take that technology, form the team around them, because they have connections with the right people and the right industries, and then fund them initially to help get them started. And we had a great green technology that was launched last year, a green hydrogen technology, that was launched out of one of these venture studios located in Baltimore.
Great, great. So, Paul, talk a little bit about some particular sectors or technologies where TechLogic Arizona, where Tucson is emerging as a hotspot for commercialization. I mentioned optics, but are there some others that are important?
Yeah, just looking at last year's kind of 13 startups, we're seeing a lot of activity in AI and technology applied to health. So we had two startups last year, iImagine Design and Symphonics launch. iImagine Design is a technology that's allowed to designed to mitigate falls among elderly people and people that are going through therapy.
Really important, yeah.
Physical therapy. And then there's also this other company, Symphonics, which was out of the College of Engineering, I believe. And Symphonics has sensors that are very high fidelity sensors for tracking people's conditions and performance. So they can wear these sensors on their bodies. So in the same way that your Apple Watch works or whatever device you're wearing.
Right.
But these are very high fidelity. They can be worn for long periods of time and they're constantly monitoring various data points that can be directly transmitted to physicians and healthcare providers to help people recover, stay right. Well, et cetera.
You kind of answered this question, and we talk about wonder about the good things going on at the U of A. So I'll ask you both, what are you most excited about looking ahead to the coming year and TLA's TechLaunch Arizona's vision for making a better world from U of A innovation? So, Paul, do you want to start?
I'm just excited to see that front end of our pipeline increasing, this increase in engagement from faculty, from staff, as well as ideally from graduate students. We are really reaching out to graduate students this year to engage them. there's so much great research going on. And with the new Senior Vice President for Research and Innovation, Tomas.
He was here last week, yeah.
Yeah. With his leadership, I think we just have some great opportunities coming to us.
Fantastic. And Bruce, your vision for the future here?
And one of the important things is we're starting to see the state come together and really in a cohesive manner to help this effort along. Before, it was kind of different efforts all focused on their own individual. And now we've really been able to kind of coalesce the state as an engine. And that's really important for states to move these technologies forward.
Well, that's fantastic. Special thanks to our guest for Wonder this morning, Bruce Burgess, Director of Venture Development, and Paul Tamarkin, Assistant Director of Marketing and Communications at Tech Launch Arizona at the University of Arizona. Sixto, thank you for being here. You know what, guys? One of our sponsors is Caruso's Italian Restaurant. There's a gift certificate from our client.
Thank you. Go down in
and take your family and enjoy some delicious food at Caruso's Italian Restaurant. And our other sponsor is Hughes Federal Credit Union. Our good friends will be on in a couple of weeks with another great story from Hughes. So, Paul, if someone wanted to learn more about this process, where do they go to get information?
Absolutely. They can go to our website at techlaunch.arizona.edu. And if you want to see the startup hub that Bruce was talking about, that's at techlaunch.arizona.edu/startup-hub. And there's videos and lots of interesting stuff about those startup
opportunities. And you guys are located over in the new sector over there, correct? Off campus a little bit?
But at the Bridges. We're in the building called the Refinery. It's got a big light on it.
I think Caleb's over there too, isn't he? He's up on the third floor. So Thank you both for being here. Really appreciate it and what you're doing for moving technology from idea to commercialization. We appreciate all you do. Tech Launch Arizona, Paul and Bruce, thank you for being here this morning on The Morning Voice.
Thank you.
We'll be back after the break with Richard Green talking about dark skies on The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me this morning in studio is Sixto Molina, who is my co-host. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, sir.
We've been through thick and thin, haven't we? We've done a lot of fun, exciting things over time, but you always talk about how we get these rocket scientists in here that are over our heads, and we're trying to have a conversation with people that are a lot smarter than you and I are. So,
you know how to intimidate a cop, I'll tell you that.
I love it. Our show is called One. And our Wonder is sponsored by our friends at Caruso's Italian Restaurant in historic 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. Our morning guest for Wonder is Richard Green. He's an astronomer at Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Ed Ackerley.
I am kind of an astronomy junkie myself. I know nothing about it, but I'm just amazed. One of the things I'll probably ask you this off air, I always ask our astronomy guests, is there an edge to the universe? You know, in the olden days, the folks said that there was an edge to the Earth and it was flat and you're going to fall off the end. And I say, okay, is the universe, is it, you know, this is that old multiverse, and are we just one of many millions and trillions of universes, or is there an edge to the universe? What's beyond that furthest light that we can see? Is there more light, and is there more universe? So we don't need to talk about that today, but we do want to talk about light, and we want to talk about the city of Tucson specifically, and how it's across the country and around the world, how light pollution is increasingly encroaching on observatories. So share a little bit about this trend and why this is important for astronomers.
I will. And just as a reminder, Tucson is really astronomy city for a reason. And you know, the University of Arizona and the National Observatory have been partners in building amazing telescopes here. So on Mount Graham is the world's largest telescope, and in the mountains around the Tucson area are 4 of the 40 of the world's largest telescopes. And they came here because of that natural renewable resource of dark skies and clear weather. And so that's why we feel it's so vital to kind of protect that, as the city has grown from 250,000 back when they first started to a metro area of now, a million plus. So the trend lately has been one of a technology change, in that you remember the lights used to be kind of pinky orange on the street lights, and around campus they were really more orangey. And so those lamps were called metal halide lamps. It was sodium vapor, for instance. The metal halide could be the bluish mercury vapor, but they had a very narrow range of color. The revolution has been these light-emitting diodes, the electronic chips, that when you excite them, they emit light powerfully for a certain amount of electricity, and they emit a broad range of colors. Mm-hmm. So what used to be dark sky in the blue and green is now illuminated a bit by the streetlights. And the more those streetlights put out their light energy in redder colors, the better it is for us to do our astronomy, but it's a big change. Mm-hmm. And the other story on those lights is that they're so efficient, the Department of Energy hoped that people would reduce the amount of electricity to get the same amount of light. But what satellite measurements seem to show is that they're keeping the power on and just getting more and more light for the same amount.
Well, Sixto and I have, we were just talking about this with our last guest. We're both getting old and we need more and more light to see as we get older. We got to be a little bit brighter so we can see, especially in a restaurant, a dark restaurant, I can't see the darn menu half the time. So
but there's another, and I am older too, and another piece of that though is that our eyes change very slowly. Mm-hmm. And so to drive out from a very bright space into a very dark space is more dangerous for us than having low, good, uniform light on that parking lot and then transitioning to the darker street. So more light doesn't mean more safety. We want to have good, responsible lighting.
The West is, as a novice here, sometimes you'll see a map of the United States and it'll be at night and, it'll be... And you'll see the East Coast and the Eastern Seaboard and up through Ohio and the Great Lakes and so forth. You'll see just a ton of lights. And then you get west of the Mississippi and you have these little pockets. Phoenix is obviously big, Los Angeles, Seattle and up in the north. But there's this big swath in the middle between the West Coast and, say, the Mississippi River where there's a lot of land where there's no lights. And does that mean that because of the land that that's... by definition, dark skies? Because I know that if me as an individual, say you go to Rocky Point and you lay on the beach and you look up at the sky, you see stars you've never seen before because you're in Tucson or Phoenix all the time and you can't see the bazillions of stars that you can in a dark sky.
So you're absolutely right. Where there are hardly any people, there's hardly any light. And that, of course, is one really good component. The reason that that hasn't therefore become the mecca of astronomy is another factor, which is that we want the airflow to be as smooth as possible so that the boiling air doesn't blur out the picture. And those wonderful big planes have pretty turbulent airflow. So another reason that the Tucson area is so magic is when you're on top of a mountain peak, the airflow is barely disturbed and you can take beautiful sharp images of the sky as well as taking advantage of the dark sky.
So you've been at the U of A for quite a while and you've been at the Stewart Observatory. How have things changed in your time there of this light around Tucson and the ability for you as an astronomer to use the instruments? Of course, the instruments have been upgraded over the last 40 years, but still, there's still a light problem in Tucson, even though it's a dark skies community.
There is, and it's just because there's a certain amount of light per person as the city grows, and the city is also spreading out in geographical areas. So it used to be Kitt Peak was very far away from the city, for example, and now the city is sort of growing out to the west. The good news is if you take the satellite data looking down and seeing how much light is coming up, there's a pretty tight relationship between the number of people living in a city and how much light is coming out of that city. Tucson falls well below that relationship. So people do care here, and they make extra effort to make sure that there isn't as much light. But nevertheless, it's been growing by, a percent a year, sort of a little slower than the growth of the population, but still growing.
There's when Six and I were running for mayor, one of the issues is safety and security. And obviously at the university, the president's number one job is safety and security. And so lighting is part of that nighttime address but there are a lot of neighborhoods in Tucson that don't actually have streetlights. They might have, I'm a good case, I live out way out east. We don't have streetlights. What we have is, in my neighborhood, every house has a mailbox light, I call them, that's out by the sidewalk. And Most of those people turn those off, you know, about 10 o'clock news. They tend to go off across my neighborhood, and it's a lot darker. And I get up in early in the morning and go walking. This is how I know this. And it's kind of dark in my neighborhood, but that light is available, obviously, if somebody needed it. But we have some neighborhoods where the lights are there all the time, and they turn on at dusk and go off at dawn. And there's a kind of a dichotomy of safety versus dark skies, right? It's a political issue, I would think. Yeah,
and I don't think so at all. I think that they can coexist, mm-hmm. and so traffic safety on an open road, your headlights are now so good and so well mm-hmm. designed that you really don't need the blinking overhead lights. The traffic safety engineers will agree that it's where pedestrians mix with cars gotcha. That you need the extra light, or where mm-hmm. it's a very complicated crossing intersection.
Good point. Right.
Then you need that extra. The other story about safety is that if you have a very bright light and a very deep shadow, the bad guy can hide in that right. shadow and you won't see them.
Right.
So, you know, having...
If, like you say, kind of a uniform...
Well-focused, low light at night so that right. your dark eye isn't suddenly contracted so that you can't see the darker areas, that's the kind of safety we're talking about. So it absolutely, it should not be attention at all if the lights are actually well designed. But you point out something that I think is also important. What we value about living in Tucson is our connection with the Sonoran Desert and, mm-hmm. you know, feeling like we're part of that desert environment, and connecting to that dark sky at night is definitely a part of that.
Yeah, we were just talking in an earlier segment that Sixto gets visits from mountain lions and snakes and all sorts of Sonoran Desert animals that come by his house all the time and visit. And it's part of the fun of living where you live, right? Is having that natural environment be part of your life.
Yeah, and it's pretty dark in my neighborhood, although, as Ed mentioned, a lot more people are putting the night lights on. So they're coming on, and the neighborhood is starting to get a little bit brighter at night than yeah. from what it used to be.
And this is not my area of expertise, but I read that the night animals that are doing their jobs are going to avoid those lights. They right. will take different routes around a neighborhood if they see lots of lights, because the coyote hunters don't want it. And so, you know, they will, it will change the natural pattern if people have the lights on right. when they don't need it. You know, technology is evolving, and we have the hopes that motion activation switches are going to be really important for us, yeah, so that
have that be the norm as opposed to
yeah,
the rarity.
You, you know, you have the light when you need it, and you don't have light when you don't need it,
right.
and that would
yeah. instead of leaving your mailbox light on for 12 hours at night, only when someone walks by it kicks on, and then or an animal walks by, and you get to make sure you don't walk into a herd of javelina. Yeah,
exactly, and you know, we all admit that requires some more technical sophistication, because, you know, the plant grows up in front of it and waves in the breeze
right.
and it's blinking on and off right. all night. So, you know, we have to get smart about how we deploy them. But that's one major step forward we hope for.
Let's take a quick break. Our guest for Wonder is astronomer emeritus at Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona, Richard Green. We will be back to talk a little bit more about dark skies, and our sponsors for Wonder are Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. You're listening to Wonder on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. This is The Morning Voice. We'll be back after a quick break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, with my co-host, Sixto Molina. On Fridays, we talk about Wonder, the good things going on at the University of Arizona. And this segment is sponsored by Hughes Federal Credit Union and by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on historic 4th Avenue. Our guest for Wonder this section is University of Arizona astronomer Richard Green at the Stewart Observatory. Before we get going, I just want to give you an envelope there. There's a gift card in there from our friends at Caruso's Italian Restaurant for you and your family to go enjoy some delicious Italian food. So,
fabulous. Thanks.
Thank you for being a guest. Sixto, you had a question about municipalities.
Yes. My question is, are the cities and towns within Pima County cooperating with the dark sky folks to keep the skies dark as much as possible?
They are. They all have outdoor lighting codes that they keep updated, and we're working on the City of Tucson, Pima County one, their code committee right now. I think they're relatively conscientious when it comes to new developments in making sure that the plans are consistent with those codes. There is always a challenge in enforcement when people change things after the fact, and there we rely on public cooperation. But these codes are developed by groups, including business developers, as well as dark sky advocates, because we need everybody to buy in to get cooperation.
Speaking of that, for listeners who may not be familiar, why should the average resident be care about if they own a business and they have lighting around it, or if they obviously own a home and they're responsible for the lighting around their home? Why should they care about dark skies and if they're not into stargazing?
Well, first of all, saves energy. Mm-hmm. If you're burning electricity for light that nobody's using, it makes sense to turn it off. Or even if you pointed your lamps up so that the light's going into the sky, it's not doing you any good. You want that light on the ground where you need to see to walk. It's interesting. The agaves that are used to produce tequila are pollinated by night pollinators, and if their pattern is disrupted by lights, we're...
Oh, that's all we need to know.
I see
switching everything off right now.
Didn't know that, but now... It's
cut the power to everything, Ed.
My whole house is going to be dark.
There you go.
That's great, Richard. I love it. Well, looking ahead, what are your hopes or predictions on for observatories, both near and far, here in Arizona, but also in Chile and around the world, how we might adapt to the growing light pollution problem?
So, first of all, I think it's doing what I'm doing right now, because it's cooperating with the communities and the countries that host these observatories to get that kind of voluntary cooperation, saying we have a treasure here. We have some of the world's best telescopes, and this helps our community. There's a big economic impact. And so just making everybody aware that they individually can do something, and solutions are low tech. If you shield your light so that none of the light goes straight up into the air, that's one of the biggest steps. And mm-hmm. and so that's step one. Chile, the country of Chile, is a very good example, because they, like Pima County, have an outdoor lighting code that's very impressive, and it is designed to protect their observatories, because the astronomy industry in that whole country
really important
has big impact, as it does here. But you ask, what will observatories do? Some of it, they will shift to problems that are less dependent on dark skies if mm-hmm. they have to. So right now, one of the hottest new issues is, what are planets like around other stars? And are there planets like our Earth, where they actually harbor life and water? And so most of those investigations are in the infrared, which is not impacted by nighttime lighting. Mm-hmm. So some of that shift will happen. And the sites that are the best protected will get yet more demand.
Right.
So northern Chile is very dark. Mauna Kea in Hawaii is very dark. Baja California is very dark, just for example. So people might take their really faintest object problems to places where the telescopes can still support it with their local dark skies.
Thank you, Richard, for coming in. Thank you, Sixto, for being here. This is Wonder on The Morning Voice, and we appreciate, Matt, what all you do. My name is Ed Ackerley. We'll see you next Friday.